When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Which farm is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's
world service.
That's... Yeah, they have asked for that, really.
Yeah, you can laugh. I was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to need it there.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down to Anfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
Brentford beat Man City. Arsenal open up a 5-point gap and will be top at Christmas, roared everyone on Sky Sports yesterday.
Well, for some reason.
Yeah, I don't know what the... Anyway, our World Cup is starting in 6 days, and yet this morning, the football world is agog at revelations that A, Manchester United has been run terribly for the last 10 years, and B, Cristiano Ronaldo has the self-awareness of a toddler. Hello and welcome to today's Second Half Football Podcast. Hello there, Ken.
Hello, Karen, how are you?
I'm good. It is a weird thing, though, isn't it? This is just so spectacularly ill-timed by Ronaldo. Such a spectacular misjudgment that it's hard to even believe it happened last night. But a point I would definitely make off the bat is that Alejandro Garnacho's thrilling last-minute goal for Man United against Fulham yesterday afternoon at around 6:15 p.m. was a real kick in the balls to this whole Pierce Ronaldo venture.
Well, I'm sure Pierce doesn't particularly mind either way. We've seen Garnacho's come and go. I'm sure that it is a knife in Ronaldo's heart to see a man less than half his age scoring the kind of goal Ronaldo can't score anymore, because in order to score that goal, Garnacho had to run all the way around De Cordova Reid. I still don't really know how that happened. I think, did De Cordova Reid think that... Is the goalkeeper going to get that? Is that going to go
help
out?
Help is coming. Yeah,
like, I can leave that. And Garnacho was in like a flash and scored that great goal. But obviously, I mean, from Ronaldo's point of view, I'm sure he didn't do the interview after the game. You know, he didn't realize it was going to be as badly. You know, just in terms of it's a great moment for United. It's a massive high to end the, you know, first part of the season on. This guy looks really good, Garnacho. He looks like he's going to be big, you know, getting a last-minute winner, and just improves everything, improves the whole situation, leaves everyone feeling good, and then suddenly, Pierce. Ronaldo with his very good friend, Pierce.
Yeah.
And the quotes, I mean, so this interview is going to be out later this week, and apparently it's a 90-minute job.
90 minutes. Yep.
Can you imagine? But what did he say? I'm sure everyone will have seen the main quotes, but betrayed. He's been betrayed by Manchester United. And honestly, I would love to sit down with Ronaldo and ask him, what do you understand by the word? But what do you think that word means? In what sense have you been betrayed?
Well, they bought him and now they're not playing him in the first team. The Manchester United first team is being selected, and the name of Cristiano Ronaldo is not on it, therefore betrayed.
Yeah, just the, you know, left wing, Garnacho, you know, right wing, whoever. Who plays right wing? Come
Anthony,
on, I should know this. It was Alanga last night.
Yeah.
You know, centre forward Martial, Ronaldo Anthony. Betrayed.
Yeah.
But, you know, so he's obviously what he's doing is he's kind of trying to burn the bridges. Mm. He's blowing up the bridges in the hope that this will force them to let him go. But, I mean, I think the thing about that is that they've known for ages that he wants to go. He was trying to leave in the summer. And it just seems like why, you know, there's a way for this to happen, but it involves Ronaldo making some concessions on his end. But he seems to sort of want it all his way, you know, in terms of him saying, okay, you owe me this, but I'll take this because I want to leave and you want me to go. So why don't we do that?
Mm.
But that would require him to reduce what he's owed.
Yeah, we'll get into it further with Dion Fanning of The Currency and Rory Smith of The New York Times in just a few minutes. But before we begin, I have a very important message, because for the very best, and I mean the very best, World Cup coverage, then please take a moment this week to consider joining the Second Captain's World Service. We will have Ken in Qatar. Ken spelled Q-E-N. He's changed it by Deepole for the entire tournament. Ken in Qatar.
This was something you mentioned earlier today, yeah. Kieran. I hadn't heard anything about it, and I don't really know if it works.
Q-E-N.
You're going with it anyway.
Q-A-T-A-R. Yes, you're goddamn right. I'm going for it. It's going to be an extraordinary 4 weeks. We'll do it justice here. So go to secondcaptains.com/join. And for just a fiver a month plus VAT, all this will be yours. The one other thing before we get into your report on sport, Ken, about the Ronaldo thing, is like we might as well get into the report on sport. Yeah. Obviously, there will be a lot of words spoken about Ronaldo, and much of them kind of critical of him, obviously. But there have been so many bad moments in this Man United season. I mean, it's not like everything has gone right for Manchester United in this season. It just so happens that Ronaldo has thrown his toys out of the pram at all of the good moments. You know, his timing so far in relation to all of these sort of pronouncements, whether through words or by actions, i.e. like just walking down the tunnel and refusing to come on in games, they've all come at the rare bright spots for Manchester United fans. The rare moments when you're like, actually, things are going broadly in the right direction. And if it wasn't for this guy, you know, pissing on the cornflakes, it would actually be, it would be even better. So that's kind of the one thing about Ronaldo's behaviour this year, is just how badly timed all of his toy throwing has.
But, you know, I mean, the low point of United season, they front loaded the misery.
Mm.
Ten Hag wisely front loaded the two worst results were the two first results. And what could he do after Brentford? He played in that game. You know, if you look at the opening goal in that game, it's Ronaldo, I think, getting beaten for a header that sort of creates that. I think Ronaldo was looking for a free kick and Brentford went and scored. You know, and then he's been left out. I mean, he doesn't care about. He's not following the trajectory of how do the fans feel about Manchester United. This doesn't impinge on his consciousness at all. I think, you know, he's not paying any attention to that. I have to say that I feel like, say, for instance, I mean, okay, just the quotes. In case you haven't, you're one of the few people in the world who haven't even seen this. I feel betrayed by the club. One or two people don't want me here, including the manager. I don't have respect for him, that's Ten Hag, because he doesn't show respect for me. If you don't have respect for me, I'm never going to have respect for you. On Rangnick, this guy is not even a coach. If you're not even a coach, how are you going to be the boss of Man United? I'd never even heard of him. That was him on Rangnick. On Rooney, I don't know why he criticises me so badly. Probably because he finished his career. I'm still playing at a high level. I'm not going to say that I'm looking better than him, which is true. and then he talked about how United, everything was the same. Mm. He arrived expecting to find the club, you know, updated and new, and actually it was the same, and it was all old and useless, and, you know, everyone knows this is not a good club anymore, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, I see Richard Keys. I always turn first to him on Monday.
Of course.
I think we've lost all respect for you now, Ronnie. You've become a pampered, egotistical disgrace of a modern-day footballer whose every whim is catered for by an army of simpering hangers-on, too scared to tell you the truth. So let me repeat.
This is actually hilarious. Like, the idea that Cristiano Ronaldo has only recently become a pampered, self-obsessed egotist. I mean, the Magnus Carlsen story you told us from a couple of months ago, about, like, and this was in, like, what, like 2014 or something?
Well, Isco, it was still at a point where when Magnus Carlsen could plausibly claim Isco was his favourite Real Madrid player. So we're talking a few years ago.
Yeah. And then the Real Madrid PR person says, we'll that's great, that but yeah, but can you just say Ronaldo's your favourite Real Madrid player? Like, this is Real Madrid, the biggest club in the world, that literally didn't think Ronaldo could handle the fact that one of their celebrity fans preferred one player to him.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it's like, it's but you know, it's like that's the story actually. In the, we spoke to Josh Robinson a couple of weeks ago about his book on Ronaldo and Messi, and the story that really leads. I mean, there's a good few stories about Ronaldo in terms of his, and it's one that we mentioned already, but just that story about how the guy from Sporting Lisbon, like the old fitness trainer from Sporting Lisbon, like drops in to visit him at Real Madrid years later. Mm. You know, You know, I'm here. I'm maybe Ronaldo would see me, you know, if he's got a minute. Yeah, no, he'd be out to you. And then he comes out eventually after like 2 hours after everyone else, because he's been getting all the treatments and all the stuff, you know, after training. And then no sooner have they started talking than Ronaldo has whipped a piece of paper out of his pocket, which lists all his achievements. And he started going through, like, look, you know, and I won this, and I won this. And yeah, and I think I was like, I know.
Where do you think I've been?
I know who you are. Like, I've actually been following your career with some pride, and now not a little concern. You know, but what I mean is this, there's something, you know, like, I actually shy back a little bit from this type of criticism of him at this point. Because, I mean, in one sense, the only difference is that he's now a pampered, egotistical disgrace of a modern-day footballer who doesn't score a goal a game anymore, right?
That's exactly
the big
like,
problem.
Like, the problem really is more that the ecosystem actively encourages this type of behaviour up until the moment that he can't score
goals anymore. And the way that the world has behaved towards him is the way the world behaves towards him is insane and is consistently like Ken repeats things he said before on the podcast day, but one of the things that made a big impression on me at the 2014 World Cup was seeing him come through the airport in Salvador after the Germany Portugal game. Germany beat Portugal 4-0. It was a disaster for Portugal. And I was in the airport in Salvador with like loads of Mexicans for some reason who were going to I think it was Fortaleza, you know. And there was all these Mexican fans, and Ronaldo, Portugal basically came through the airport, but they were in like they were in an adjacent sort of hall that had been kind of sealed off from all the rabble. And so the players came walking through and walking ahead of everybody, miles ahead of everybody was Ronaldo, who I remember looked like a kind of a schoolboy in his knee high, compression socks. Mm. And his shorts and his school bag on his back, and he comes and obviously it's like, whoa, it's Ronaldo, and so all the people just started behaving in the most insane way. Like, first of all, they were all kind of like, oh, you know, like Ronaldo, like trying to get him basically to sort of, I don't know, give them a thumbs up for a photo or whatever. Yeah. But he kind of glanced at them and kind of kept his head down and just kept walking with this kind of determined stride. And the crowd then, when they realized he wasn't going to kind of dance, that wasn't going to do the dancing bear, they then just started abusing him and like slamming on the window, you know, like kids, like tormenting an animal at the zoo, you know, like horrible kids, or and then chanting Messi, and all this kind of stuff, you know, just to sort of, and so I always thought about that, like, this is, I just thought it was kind of mad. This is what he gets all the time, you know, like this is what people are to him, like just this massive, like, you know, the way that fame, extreme fame of the nature that he has, he's literally the most famous person anyone who sees him has ever laid eyes on.
Yeah.
And the way that that makes people behave is so, it's so distorting.
Yeah, but I mean, that is the nature of celebrity and all the rest. The idea of football is that you have 10 teammates and you have 20 teammates. You know, that you have a dressing room where, okay, everyone is very famous, and that there is an equality there. There is a level of treatment that every player gets in there that, like, you can't expect unbelievably rich footballers to expect people to treat them normally, you know, given the industry that they're in. But in a dressing room, you actually can expect that, you know, or at least in a broad sense, that a football club will treat someone actually, you know, on a par. But like, that Ronaldo has no interest in that. You know what I mean? Like, it's not, I've been dropped. It's not, he doesn't believe me as a player. I'm betrayed.
Well, the story of his career has always been really about him, you know, and he has always been the best player for his team. And it's always been, you know, he's been doing these incredible things and he has been above the other players. You can say there's supposed to be equality, and there should be. And, you know, someone like Christian Eriksen, I'm sure, is, you know, he's got like, you can see how he is with his teammates. I mean, what did I think about Ericsson? Most players are like this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But Ronaldo is not like most players. And I feel as though the way the world has behaved around him, I mean, I don't mean to put the blame for his faults on the world, but I do feel as though the kind of way that he is now has been a two-way process. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And this kind of, how can you really spend too much time thinking about, you know, other people having minds and being there? When every time you see people, they behave like animals towards you.
Yeah, they literally go out of their mouths.
Yeah. So it's like, it's kind of, I don't know, you know. Yeah. But look, we'll talk again more about that. I mean, there was some incredible stuff happened over the weekend. Obviously, the most amazing result was Brentford.
Yeah.
Making Manchester United's defeat to Brentford not look so bad, because at least they lost away and not at home like Man City managed to do. And, you know, this was actually a brilliant game. And Brentford could have won the game by more. Which is the great, like, City just never really got a grip of the game. And there was a moment really early in the game when the ball sort of broke. Brentford was just defending, and the ball broke, and Rico Henry sprinted up the field with the ball. Just like, there was no doubt in his mind when he won the ball, or the ball, you know, he got onto the ball 30 yards from his own goal line, that he was going to go all the way to the other end of the field. Like, there was no decision at any point. There was no contemplation of any other thing that he might do. It was just like, here we go. And City were kind of rocked by this. You know, that resulted in a chance. I think Ederson ended up making a good save. Tony could have scored 4 goals. I mean, he scored 2, and he really could have. He had good chances.
The goal could have been his hat-trick goal after 15 minutes.
Well, they had a chance at 99 minutes when it was already 2-1, which they only missed because it was like, it was one of those, my God, there's 3 of us against 1.
Yeah.
We have to score.
Kevin De Bruyne.
We have to score. And they were almost sort of too careful with what they did, and it ended up getting cleared by De Bruyne on the line. The whole approach was interesting. I mean, Pep referred to the long balls, which is exactly correct by him, because there was more long passes by Brentford than in any other game by any other team this season. But they just said, we're not even going to try to pass the ball through midfield. We're either going to run directly through there, or we're going to hit Tony with a long ball and make sure we've got a bunch of players around him. And City just couldn't do anything about this. You know, I mean, The problem with doing that against City is that they will get the ball, and then you won't get it back for 3 or 4 minutes, and eventually it just becomes giving them the ball. But on this occasion, Tony was just getting the better so much of Laporte and Akanji or whoever City had up against him, that that Brentford kept winning the ball in good positions. And so, I mean, there's an obvious template there. I mean, because it neutralized City's City's strengths. I mean, the City themselves didn't play that well, but
teams don't have not many teams have a guy as good as Ivan Toney at this particular role.
Most teams do not have a player who can actually do what he was doing, and you know, if they did, you know, those players have kind of I don't want to say phased out, but like, it's certainly been less of an emphasis, like the aerial game, in terms of what you can actually do with it than all the other aspects of the game. So this side of things have been neglected. City are obviously not adapted to play against it. Most of the time, they don't have to play against it.
Yeah.
And so on this occasion, it was great. I mean, obviously, then it creates this fantastic situation for Arsenal. I know you're saying top of Christmas. They're actually top after 14 matches, though, which is a few matches less than you've usually about 18 or 19. And the team that was top after 14 games last season was Chelsea, amazingly. Who finished 19 points behind City, who they were 1 point ahead of after 14 games. And the season before, who was leading the league? 2021, the COVID season.
Oh, so not Liverpool.
It was Liverpool.
Was it?
It was Liverpool. They were leading the league after 14 matches, and then they proceeded to lose all their games for the next 7 weeks.
I was wondering when exactly the collapse came. I thought it was maybe...
They were 5 points ahead of Man City at that point. City, who had won only 6 out of 13 matches, 8 points ahead with 13, and then City played the extra one. So it was 5 points ahead, and then finished 17 points behind. Mm. So City can turn those things around.
Yeah, not quite the Stonewall guarantee of success.
City are a team that can do this, but they haven't hit that sort of form. I mean, I was just looking at them saying, you know, how good are they really compared to themselves?
Mm.
And the answer is not as good as the 18 and 19 teams that won the league had scored more goals, had conceded far fewer goals at this point than this current City team. And, you know, Haaland is like oh my God, you know, everyone's been like, just, he's literally wowed the entire world. But City were scoring more goals in the 18 and 19 seasons. You know what I mean? So that these are the sorts of things that Guardiola will be pissed off about.
It sounded like you were about to start throwing flowers at Arsenal there. And I know a lot of Arsenal fans would be concerned that you may have been sidetracked there in some way. So I want to get you back on the road there, Ken, and ensure that you do what needs to be done to Arsenal. Top of Christmas.
They're top of Christmas. No one.
I mean, it's honestly like.
You might dispute the significance of the statistic.
The Premier League basically turned into John Lewis or Tesco or someone. It suddenly just became all about Christmas yesterday to like an extraordinary degree. I couldn't believe what I was hearing.
Yeah. Well, Arsenal are in great position now. But you know, again, because you've seen what's happened the last couple of seasons where City just get on a roll and suddenly nobody can. It's just 3 points, 3 points, 3 points, 3 points. And Arsenal get a draw and then they lose a game. They still have to play City twice. And so it kind of comes down to those games. Because, you know,
it's still in City's hands as we move into
the title. If City win all the games, then they're going to win the league.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, it's in Arsenal's hands as well. Maybe is it in Tottenham's hands? I'm not sure it is. Tottenham, by the way, I don't know how they managed to get away with they won 4-3. They're addicted to going two goals down now and suffering. They're like, oh.
Well, this time they went a goal down three times.
Yeah, no, they did. Were they not 3-1 down at one point? Well, maybe.
No, it was 2-2, then 3-2. So they just went down, went a goal down three times rather than.
But they, the first goal, the Kane goal. How was that allowed?
You just started talking about Spurs again. Like, you're refusing to talk about Arsenal. It's actually unbelievable.
No. That's not true. But I was about to make a point, which I'm sure Arsenal listeners will agree with. I don't know how that goal still.
Oh, the first goal, outrageous.
He like, literally rugby tackles Messi into his net and pinned him into his net, like a dolphin in a tuna net. And suddenly suddenly Kane just kicks it in, and we're all supposed to say that's fine.
Mm.
Well, this is, you know,
Captain England Captain of England, Ken. I just did what you always do.
Yeah,
it's a World Cup week. Yeah. World Cup is starting. England's captain needs a goal.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, and of course, Darwin Núñez. I'm getting a lot of Twitter abuse from Liverpool fans who DM me to tell me what, you know.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, to say
interesting choice.
You know, how can you?
Is that out of concern for you? That they don't want their own followers to see just how terribly they're about to own you in a DM.
No, I don't really mind, but it appears that I've set myself up as I wrote Darwin Núñez off.
Mm.
It appears that people now, did I do that?
Ooh.
I don't think
you expressed a lot of doubts about his ability as a Premier League footballer.
I think I was a little I was intrigued by some of what I was seeing. Mm.
Yeah, you did. I would say that
I used four letter word. Yips.
Yips.
The word was yips.
Mm.
And what would you say about yips? Is that a permanent?
That's a temporary scenario. Yeah.
It's a temporary scenario.
Mm.
So,
seven goals and an assist in his last 10 games. Is that correct?
I saw the comparisons with Haaland have come roaring back.
Mm.
Someone was saying seven. Non-penalty goals since October 16th or whatever. Whatever date it was that Haaland...
The day after Haaland's last hat-trick.
And and Núñez has seven and Haaland has only got one since that date. So all I'm saying, he's on pace to pass Haaland out around March. So we'll see how that one pans out.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Where can there be a goodness me! He just kicked! He punched the fan! Eric Cantona has jumped in and scissor kung fu kick! A fan! Manchester United fans are coming across! I have never seen as disgraceful an incident as that in all my years in football! Eric Cantona should be thrown out of the game for that sort of incident! I care not one jot about his supreme talent! He launched himself 6 feet into the crowd and kung fu kicked a supporter!
All right, well, Rory Smith is on the line. How are you doing, Rory?
I'm all right. How are you?
And here with us in studio is Dion Fanning. How are you, Dion?
Hey, Ken. How's it going?
Very well. Now, it was, it's the last weekend of the Premier League until after Christmas. And it was a great weekend, but we have to start by talking about someone who didn't even play. And I'm actually unsure where to even start with this Ronaldo interview because, like, what more is there to be said? At this point, I mean, it's an explosive interview. It's a blast, but like, what does it change, Dion?
It doesn't change anything. It's an explosive interview. It's true, but it's also managed to be an explosive interview, which doesn't tell us anything that we didn't know already. And some of the stuff seems to be only a shock to somebody as self-obsessed and narcissistic as Ronaldo. You know, he has to kind of gently break it to Piers Morgan that there were people at the club who didn't want him around. And like, you know, I'm going to shock you now with this information. And we know that.
Yeah. Although they didn't let him go. I mean,
they didn't let him. But like at the same time, you can tell that by as it's unfolded this season, that there are people that would be happier for him to not be there.
Yeah.
He seemed to do a bit of a PR exercise by, I think, trying to, you know, align himself with the supporters who feel that things have just, there's been a rot at the club, you know, for 10 years by saying that nothing has changed. But unfortunately, this seemed to lead him down a road of actually, criticising the fact that the chefs were still the same as they were when he left the club. And then he had to kind of really realise, even Ronaldo realised that actually...
That's good.
That's a nice thing about the club.
A
nice touch about
the gear should be better. They should have new ovens. They should have all, you know...
Technology in the kitchen. I was kind of interested in that.
Technology and infrastructure. Yeah. It's all lacking. But I mean, in that sense, I suppose he echoes a lot of complaints that everybody has... Well, Manchester United fans have been making consistently about the Glazers' lack of investment in the, you know, there was a bit of truth mixed in.
But the truth was mixed in. But the greatest emblem of Manchester United's failure to progress was sitting opposite Piers Morgan doing the interview.
Yeah.
Because he's back at the club. Like that was the failure, and again, this idea that of the three coaches he worked under, the only one he speaks fondly of is Solskjaer.
Mm.
Tells you everything, because when it was being run as a theme park for the old Manchester United and the Manchester United way, and they weren't parking in Alex Ferguson's car park spot and they were visiting the cliff and all this kind of stuff, that was kind of, Ronaldo was happy enough with that in his own way, and he's only there because of their failure to move on.
Yeah.
And if Erik ten Hag had been there a year ago, would that have happened? I really doubt it.
Rory, what did you make of it? Is this a pure masterstroke by Ronaldo?
Not so much. No, I think I agree with Dion. I'm not sure that there's anything particularly new in it. I think some of it is feels slightly embittered, slightly more personal than maybe we'd realised. But the thing that really struck me was the strangeness of seeing Ronaldo, who is, you know, probably one of the two most famous footballers who've ever lived, talking to Piers Morgan, who admittedly, like, he obviously isn't everyone's cup of tea, but he's a major kind of social presence, millions and millions of followers on Twitter and stuff. But on a TV channel that I think is called Talk TV, which I don't know how to receive, and I'm guessing the vast majority of people in Britain don't know how to receive either.
You ever heard of YouTube.com, Rory?
Well, this is it. This is what I think is really interesting about it, that I suspect that the reason that Ronaldo's PR people have gone to him and said, look, we should do this interview with Piers Morgan, which I'm guessing Piers Morgan solicited, isn't because lots of people will actually watch it, but it's because they will see, millions and millions and millions of people will see the three or four sentences that matter. Then this hasn't been done. You know, he's not sat down with CNN for a bid heart to heart, or you know, NBC or Sky or BT or whatever. He's not gone out and he doesn't want a sort of in-depth interview. What he effectively
it's a 90-minute interview, apparently.
But he doesn't want people to see 90 minutes. It's not being done to get people to see 90 minutes. It's being done because they know that certain clips of it, 4, 5, 6 clips of it, will go viral straight away. And I think that in itself is quite interesting, that Ronaldo doesn't really want to explain himself. He doesn't necessarily want to have his ideas challenged or to kind of get his... kind of like explore the situation. He wants to get his message across in a way that will be presented effectively unchallenged. And that's not because Piers Morgan won't challenge him. Who knows, in the 90 minutes, maybe Piers Morgan really hauls him over the coals. I don't know. I think it's fascinating that they've done it with an outlet that is exclusively designed to get people to see 30-second, minute-long clips rather than the full 90-minute Farrago. And that in itself, I think, is quite just really struck me that it's so strange, because he is, you know, go to any broadcaster in the world and say Cristiano Ronaldo wants to talk to you,
yeah,
that broadcaster will say yes, and yet he's gone to what is ultimately a relatively minor channel in a market that doesn't really matter particularly, because he's not going to play for another English club. But it just sort of indicates to me the shifting landscape of the global media.
Well, I mean, he follows Kanye West, who was talking to Pierce recently. Jordan Peterson was on Pierce quite recently. So, you know, this is
interesting company to be keeping.
Yeah, he's had a few big interviews in the last little while. But if by your rationale, then the key sort of takeaways from this interview are probably already out. You know,
yeah.
So what did he actually say? He said, I didn't even know who Ralf Rangnick is. That guy's not even a coach. He said, I don't respect Erik ten Hag, which is, I mean, that is probably, of all the things I've seen from the interview, that is probably the most, the most final, in the sense, okay, we started off saying, what does it really change? Is there anything here we didn't already know? And there isn't much we didn't already know. We kind of knew he hated the situation and wanted out. I mean, he tried to leave the club in the summer and he's been sulking the entire season. But the fact that he's now said to Piers Morgan, I don't respect Erik ten Hag, surely means that's it for him there now.
Yeah, I would have thought so. But the problem in January is the same problem as he had in the summer, that there's no market for Cristiano Ronaldo, certainly not on the sort of money that he would expect. So I think the closest he came to leaving in the summer was for Sporting Lisbon, which feels like the natural kind of end point of his career. It has a romantic arc. I think he would come out of it quite well if he spent the last year or two of his career back at the club where it all started. You can really sell that story. And by all accounts, Sporting basically said they didn't really fancy it. It was a massive financial commitment. It would define the way they played. It kind of changes the project that Ruben Amorim, the coach, has been building. And they kind of got cold feet rather than Ronaldo. So I don't quite know where Ronaldo goes. You know, a lot of the escape routes have disappeared for players of that size and that stature, because there's no Russia, there's no China. Turkey, I think, would really struggle to... There'd be very few clubs in Turkey who could meet his wages. And it also feels... it's a little bit budget going to Turkey. Do you know what I mean? It's not something necessarily. If you go to China, you can sell it as I'm trying to conquer this brave new world. If you go to Turkey, it's very obvious what you're doing. And I think for various reasons, Ronaldo probably isn't going to go to MLS. So I'm not quite sure where Cristiano Ronaldo pitches up, to be honest.
Well, I wonder if you could see. I know initially the Champions League was part of his thinking, but. And it's almost an extension of doing an interview with Piers Morgan, because I agree with you, Rory, about like what it says about him. But it also tells you, again, how important that I don't want to quite say sycophantic, because we haven't seen the interview. But that having somebody who is clearly like in Cristiano Ronaldo's corner and is adoring of the Cristiano Ronaldo myth, how important that is to him. Yeah. And Piers Morgan, clearly, if reading the piece that Piers Morgan wrote about this, you know, they've been in contact and they've...
I text him all the time. We text each other, yeah. But I'd say Piers Morgan probably sends most of the texts.
Yeah, tells him how magnificent he is. And, you know, we've seen it with the dwindling, like the kind of, you know, the Back to the Future picture of people are, you know, disappearing, like as he refuses to shake hands with various members of the Sky panel. You know, one week it's Carragher, one week it's Gary Neville. So, like, it is, his world is shrinking because of his demand for worship.
Mm.
So I think that could be what happens with his next move as well. And so then somewhere like Saudi Arabia or wherever comes into play, because it's where can I go where I will be loved, rather than where can I go where I will get Champions League football.
You see, as you were saying that, Dion, I was kind of thinking, right, well, what you need to look out for then is who is football's equivalent of Piers Morgan? And the answer to that question is Jose Mourinho.
Oh, Jose.
And I can't remember exactly how the relationship between those two stands at the moment. You always hear various bits of one of them resents the other or something.
Between Jose and Ronaldo or Jose and Piers?
Jose and Ronaldo. Jose and Piers, I imagine, are very close and text each other all the time.
Yeah.
But a club like Roma, in a previous world, a player in Ronaldo's position, and to be fair, there's no direct parallel, because I don't think we've ever seen a player whose peak has lasted as long as Messi and Ronaldo's. That has never happened before. But a player in Ronaldo's position would go to like a Roma or a Valencia, and to a club that is prepared to build the team around them, where they can kind of age gracefully, and they still have that sense of playing in a big stadium, on a big stage for a big club. They can compete for honours. They might even get to play in the Champions League. You wonder whether, Mendes is connected at those two clubs, at Valencia and at Roma. Those are the natural homes for someone like Ronaldo, but it involves him accepting a degradation in status, and it's certainly accepting a wage cut. And it's whether he's able to get over those two obstacles. So Saudi, I suppose, is the one place that he might be able to go and see out. Saudi or Qatar, I suppose, are the two countries where he'd go and see out kind of his final years in relative anonymity and just get a load of money. But if he wants to keep competing, if he wants to at least create the illusion that he is still a relevant factor, he probably has to go to kind of a second-tier European club.
He might just stay in Qatar.
Yeah.
Never come back.
Yeah, he could just stop in Qatar, to be fair, yeah.
What do you, just to finish on this, how do you think this is actually going to end then? If it's January, what do they do? Is it worth simply paying him off and saying, look, we actually don't care what you do, you're no longer our problem now?
If he feels so betrayed, Ronaldo probably should say to United, let's just cancel the contract unilaterally. If that is genuinely what he wants and he's not interested in the money at all, he should just cancel his contract. Cristiano Ronaldo has enough money. And I don't generally advocate for players walking away from money that they're owed. But in this case, you sort of think, well, if it's that bad, just walk away.
Yeah, I think that would be the obvious way of doing it. It means he doesn't even have to deal with a kind of awkward couple of weeks around Christmas, where he'd have to be back. And he could have to be back in two and a half weeks or 3 weeks if Portugal got knocked out in the first round. It might be.
They've got a difficult group.
Yeah.
It's Uruguay, Ghana and South Korea. So there's every chance of them getting knocked out in the first round, I think.
And then he's back, for three uncomfortable weeks with Erik ten Hag. So maybe it is just a question of looking to cancel the contract.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the obvious thing from our point of view. It may not be so obvious from Ronaldo's point of view that's what he should do, because he seems to often not... comes to the same conclusions as other people about how certain behaviors will be received.
And again, we talked about this a few weeks ago. That is what's left of Ronaldo, the belief in Cristiano Ronaldo.
Do you feel sorry for him?
Do I feel sorry for him?
Because he's trapped in this kind of, what's the word? I mean, the first word that came to my mind is crazy. I don't want to use that word. He's trapped in this very...
hubristic, isn't it?
The mindset is not... Do you see what he said about Rooney?
Yeah, well, that was very Trumpian.
It's not like something a normal person would say. In the sense, it's like, oh, I'm better looking than Wayne Rooney. Yeah. I mean, you're 37 years old. Yeah,
Hang on. Is Donald Trump better looking than Wayne Rooney? I don't know if that's true.
But Donald Trump would say that he is.
He would say that he is, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
He would say that kind of thing. But I think he may also...
I do feel sorry for him, because I do... And I also think he has gone through incredible hardship personally in the last year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because it's Ronaldo, it seems to be viewed... Again, because of that personality he has, those things don't seem to be as... foremost in people's thoughts as they would be with somebody else, which is you have to have some sympathy for somebody who's gone through that and also has, as you say, developed this kind this personality that is you know, when you see him being interviewed and you hear him talking, and it's such a, he's such a peculiar, he is such a peculiar creation practically at this stage, that it's strange looking at him. And then you do feel there is there, you have to have some kind of sympathy for what he's put himself in. But at the same time, it is that thing that is left. He's always had this. And I remember, it's funny, reading the Rooney thing. I remember that story about towards the end of his time, first time at United, and Rooney was doing, I think it was around the Munich. It was the 50th. Yeah,
I think I remember the story where he was doing some press engagement and Ronaldo sticks his head.
Yeah, Rooney was doing it, and Ronaldo had done his, and Rooney was doing his, and Ronaldo stuck his head in, and then when nothing happened, he started just banging on the window furiously, saying, finish it, hurry up. Yeah. And again, everybody overlooked that. Nobody says anything because it's Cristiano Ronaldo.
That would have been the 50th anniversary of Munich, 2008.
So everyone is like, you know, we're not going to do anything to upset Cristiano Ronaldo. And then there comes a time when nobody really wants to put up with this stuff. And you probably have a choice then. Do you somehow modify your behaviours if you're capable of doing that? Or do you just keep seeking? And again, you know, the clips of ignoring Neville and things like that are kind of revealing of that, because it's like, rather than saying, okay, I'm now going to kind of accept that I've reached a stage in my career where there are valid criticisms to be made of me, I'm going to take another turn. And again, this is Trumpian as well. Like, you know, it's like, you know, Trump refusing to disown anybody, you know, who shows any fondness for him.
Yeah.
You know,
although he walked out of a Pierce interview.
Do you not think as well that even the, like, the focus on respect is just it's very puerile? It feels like the sort of thing that a 37-year-old incredibly successful person probably shouldn't be banging on about quite as much. Like, that the ultimate kind of currency in Ronaldo's mind and in his world is respect. And the sense I got from that clip, and again, we don't know the full context of the interview, but was that he kind of doesn't respect Ten Hag because he feels like Ten Hag doesn't respect him.
Well, he said that I don't get any respect, so I'm not going to give him any respect.
I mean, that's the logic of a child. And there's lots and lots of giveaways that just sort of suggest that Ronaldo, because he's been so famous for so long, because he's surrounded by yes men, because he you know, his every whim has always been attended to, because everyone has indulged him. There is a kind of unformedness to Ronaldo where he's not like a proper adult. I think that comes through quite a lot with Ronaldo. There's a lot of kind of stroppiness about him. Mm. But the other thing that I think is really important is that what Ronaldo's been through, the way it's not even mentioned. I think it's probably not mentioned. A lot of people find it hard to contemplate. But there should probably be quite a lot of leeway for quite a lot of his behaviour since that point, from both the club and externally, because that is, I mean, he's lived through a complete nightmare. And Dion's right. It is just kind of like, well, it's Ronaldo. So, yeah, all right, we'll mention it, but it doesn't, it's not sort of factored into how we discuss him at any point. And that feels a little bit harsh to me.
Yeah, it is unfair. Well, we will eagerly await the 90 minutes of Pierce and Ronaldo, which is broadcast later this week. In terms of the football that actually happened, one of the interesting games was the one at Newcastle. And this was a really bitterly contested game, as though Chelsea, who lost the game, sensed that there was more at stake than just the points. That this was a kind of, and I've had this impression in a couple of Newcastle games this season. The one at Anfield, for example, which they ended up losing, was, it kind of felt like there's a lot more going on here. You know, we're sort of the rising club now. We're kind of we're actually going to push you people out of, you know, the knock you off your perch. Let's say there was a bit of that going on. And I have to start by asking Rory, Eddie Howe, is he doing a great job, or is the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia doing a great job?
Well, both. I don't think those things are mutually exclusive. Like,
Who's
doing the better job? I think it would be difficult for Newcastle to be in third if they hadn't spent £200 million on players. I think that is the way that I'd maybe characterise that. Howe has done a really good job with the players that he has been bequeathed. And he has also, the other thing I think that's really, really impressive about Howe is that he he seems to have kind of addressed a lot of the weaknesses in his own coaching that were fairly obvious throughout his time at Bournemouth. Like what Eddie Howe did at Bournemouth was spectacular and really impressive, but there was always that sense that his teams were much better with the ball than they were without it, that they were quite easy to play through, that they were kind of nice opponents. That has all gone out of the window at Newcastle. And I think Howe, while he was out of work, did a lot of those things that always sound a little bit like jollies to me, but apparently coaches think they're really important. You know, he went to Italy to watch Italian teams train defensively. He went and watched Diego Simeone's team. He went and watched Atletico Madrid train for 3 days to work out what they were doing defensively. He sought advice and opinions to try and improve the flaws in his own coaching. And he deserves credit for that. What he has done is really impressive, but his attempt to pretend that the money is not relevant was a very, very thin. But also I don't really understand why you'd even try. Like, obviously you need to spend a lot of money to do it. He doesn't have to go into the morality of being a state-owned club. But, you know, it feels like even Guardiola will say, I've got amazing players. Even Pep has the kind of self-awareness to think, all right, you know, I better at least acknowledge that. Whereas trying to dismiss it and pretend that this is some sort of underdog fairy tale actually diminishes the extent to which Newcastle, this season at least, still is a bit of an underdog story.
You, do you feel it as an underdog story, Dan? Are you thinking this is like 95, 96 or 93, 94 all over again, seeing this rampant young Newcastle team?
No, but I do think it's probably happened quicker than I anticipated. I think, it is very early and there's a lot of reasons. The failures of other clubs, including Liverpool and Chelsea, obviously contributing to the fact that Newcastle are where they are. So there is a sense that it is happening at a pace that is a bit quicker. With, you know, Newcastle have spent a lot of money, but they also haven't got to that stage where, like next summer, the players you would expecting them to sign would be the players that are really going to make you think, okay, then now they're spending
you
money.
You mean it won't be Mbappe and Bellingham, it'll be James Maddison and...
Just in the next stage of it, whereas now there is a combination of the two. They obviously signed some very good players, but they've also got, and Eddie Howe has got more out of the players that were there.
Don't you think that has a lot to do with the overall sort of picture of what's happening at the club, you know, in the sense that suddenly Newcastle is a club to be at if you're a player. Whereas previously it was when, you know, they're owned by Mike Ashley and managed by Steve Bruce. This is a place you want to escape from. Like the motivation for playing well is maybe somebody will save me. Whereas now it's like, well, you know, I could have a really big career at this club. I could make a lot of money, win a lot of stuff, you know, and that is surely a big motivation for players.
It is, but I think and I don't want to sound like I'm defending Eddie Howe to the hilt. There's plenty of people who do that already. But I think the flip side of that is that when you get a big investment into a club as you've had at Newcastle, is that a lot of the players know that journey will not necessarily include them. Mm. So I think the test for a manager, more than a coach, but a manager, is to persuade the players that they might have a long-term career at the club, that they might be able to, as Dion says, like fulfill all their dreams and ambitions and wishes at that club, rather than allowing them to wonder if perhaps next summer James Maddison might arrive and take their place. And I think that is something that Howe has managed quite effectively. And even in the circumstances and with all the kind of queries and quibbles about kind of exactly what the nature of the project at Newcastle, I think you can give him credit for the way he has been able to kind of galvanize the team behind that sense of, right, this is exciting, rather than this is going to be really exciting but for better players than you lot.
What do you think of the situation then of Graham Potter, who started well, had a decent unbeaten run, and has now taken 2 points from his last five league games and only scored 2 goals in the five and lost the last three and also lost to City in the league. It's getting a bit boring at this stage.
It's getting... They need to really roll out those pieces again from when he was appointed about what a deep thinker he is.
But he is, though, isn't he?
He is, yeah.
I think, is he too deep a thinker for Chelsea? I don't mean that to sound insulting to Chelsea, but what I mean is Chelsea, when I look at them, the managers who've been successful there, or most successful, are these charismatic lion tamer managers. And, you know, Mourinho, obviously, Conte, you know, Ancelotti, you know, Hullett and Vialli were kind of star managers, you know, whereas the more coachy type managers,
AVB,
Henry Villas-Boas, yeah. Benitez, I mean, Benitez was complicated by other things, and maybe now Potter just didn't, let's say, capture the imagination of the Stamford
Bridge.
Well,
yeah, I guess the only, again, the difference was that they were working under a different regime as well, where you probably not only needed to capture the attention of the Chelsea crowd, you needed to capture the attention of Roman Abramovich.
And you don't think Todd Bowley had a short attention spell?
Well, I would, if I was, you know, if I was to really put a pin in my collar and ask, does Todd Bowley have a short attention span, I would say yes.
Yeah.
But there is still the possibility that he doesn't, and he presumably, now it is a bit of a presumption given the way he's operated since the summer, he presumably knew what he was getting with Potter, and it was never going to be exciting, that's the thing, it was never going to be one of those, you know, there is no show business,
yeah,
to Graham Potter. And maybe Chelsea think they can get that somewhere else. But, you know, you look at Bowley trying to sign Ronaldo, those kind of things. Like, yeah, there's a part of him that is still drawn to and motivated by something of, you know, of the business called show. And,
yeah, yeah,
you know, and Graham Potter is not that person. He's a person that, you know, you really want in your corner if you're kind of buying some kind of pension scheme.
Well, he could be a kind of...
the thing is that... And you couldn't really... I feel a bit bad admitting this, but like, you couldn't really say it at the time, because when Chelsea appointed Potter, there was this sense of, like, he's done an amazing job at Brighton, and he's kind of the vanguard of the new type of British coach, and, you know, he's sophisticated and he's a thinker and he does all these clever tactical things that we don't really associate with domestic managers. But his Brighton team were quite patchy, and he got the Chelsea job at a time when he was very much on the upswing. You know, things were going really well. Moises Caicedo had emerged as one of the best midfielders in the country, and, you know, they were getting good results, and teams were going to the Amex and getting swept away by this kind of inventive and intelligent football. But there had been a period, I think not that long beforehand, when he'd gone like 9 games without a home win, and where Brighton hadn't won for 10. And I just wonder whether... I'm fully invested in the Graham Potter story and have been since Ostersunds. I think he seems like a really nice bloke, and he is without question a good coach. But I do wonder whether he is a bit of a kind of tinkerer. He does like to have his tactical impact on games. And I just wonder whether there's a part of his process that is, you know, the experiments will every so often catch fire and something will work for a while. But in between, there's a lot of times when he's kind of twiddling, tweaking and doing all that stuff, and it's not really having the desired impact. And it just seems like Chelsea kind of in that spell now. And I think that got forgotten when he got the job, that he went on quite a lot of runs at Brighton where things weren't great. And because it was Brighton, we kind of ignored it. Because, you know, if Brighton don't win for 6 games, who really cares? Nobody in the broader scheme.
Well, the Brighton fans booed him, of course. He was booed by the Brighton fans. So don't forget that.
Yeah, so I just wonder whether there is maybe a slight... This is maybe part of the Potter experience more than we kind of gave it credit for at the time, and maybe more than Bowley realised.
Yeah. I also sort of do wonder as well, there aren't that many big teams where they change the formation and change the sort of tactical approach game to game a lot, I don't think. I mean, usually, City is an obvious counterexample to that, but still, you know, the structure of City, he tends to use the same players a lot, you know, yeah. He's used fewer players than the other teams, and maybe at a big club that just kind of starts annoying people a little bit more than at a smaller club where you're like, well, we have to be clever. You know, Chelsea shouldn't have to be clever. I wonder though, Rory, if you think Todd Bowley, this is the other thing I was thinking watching that game. I thought, what is Todd Bowley's plan here? This is in the week where FSG, well, it's reported that FSG want to sell Liverpool, and, you know, they seem to, you know, there was another story, David Ornstein had that, you know, Mike Gordon, who's been kind of their guy on the ground, on the ground in Boston, but sort of running the club from their point of view, is now stepping back to focus on selling clubs. So it does look like this is going to happen. And if they're thinking, yeah, it's time to cash out of this now, you know, maybe we've taken it as far as we can, and, you know, they're letting in Saudi Arabia and we didn't get the Super League and, you know, really, what's the upside? I can see the downside, but where's the upside come from? So they're deciding, apparently, to cash out. At just the moment that Todd Bowley cashes in, he arrives, pays a record sum for the club. They've jacked up the interest rates, I think, 3% since he came in May. The Fed rate has gone up by 3%.
He's all in on the All-Star game. That's his,
Do you think there is a plan there? What does Todd Bowley know that FSG doesn't know?
Well, the word that people keep coming back to is basically streaming. That appears to be everybody's plan. Like Bowley said that he thinks Premier League teams will be worth three times their current values, or, you know, they'll all be worth $10 billion or whatever when he bought Chelsea. I think he believes that, and the revenue stream that is untapped is streaming, that they think if they can break clear of the tyranny of the organised broadcasters and just do it themselves, then that is where the money is. And maybe that's right. But I've got to say, and I'll be cast as an FSG loyalist, and to an extent that's probably true, but I'm not convinced that anyone who's spending $2.5 billion or
rising to 4.25, well, yeah, but that, according to,
but that was money committed on the stadium and the squad. That's that was a slightly misleading and to an extent meaningless figure. But you know, paying a kind of premium fee for a Premier League team, I'm not convinced that that's going to be the smart money. I think the smart money got in earlier. I think FSG were the smart money.
Or Saudi Arabia and Newcastle. I mean, they paid $300 million for Newcastle.
Different, you know, ambitions for their investments. But I don't know if someone pays that much money. I don't know if they're. I think you're basically reliant on someone who wants it as a trophy asset. I don't quite see Bowley's projections. And the other thing that factored into FSG's decision, by all accounts, was their expectation, and these are people who have made their money in the futures markets, that things are about to get worse around the world. So they think, well, now, you know, if you don't sell now, you probably have to wait another 5 years or 6 years or whatever before you can get the same amount of money. That seems to be the logic that FSG have gone for, and I can't contradict them. So yeah, it does feel like maybe Bowley bought at just the wrong time. Although, having said that, he did it after the pandemic and after the invasion of Ukraine, so maybe he should have seen it coming. Yeah. And I don't see quite how he gets his massive return, which is ultimately that's what they're all in it for. All of the American investors are in it to make money off football. They don't want to. They're not building they're not sports washing. They're not building the image of a nation. They don't have some ulterior motive. They're just there for the cash. They want to make money. I don't quite see how Bowley does it at this stage, but at the same time, I'm not a billionaire, so maybe he kind of he sees something that we mere mortals can't. I think we all accept now that wealth is a proxy for virtue. I think that's the way society is now constructed.
The other thing about it is that he has also he can say what he likes. Like the people he's persuaded are actually Clear Lake Capital, who put in the money too. So he has persuaded them about the possibilities of streaming being the thing that will multiply the value of football clubs and of Chelsea in particular. And yet there's been a lot of talk around streaming and various, you know, clubs have been talking for quite a long time about breaking away from, you know, collective rights and selling the rights themselves, whether it's on their own channels or streaming or whatever. Maybe streaming is the way that's going to happen as people get used to watching on Amazon Prime or whatever. But also against that, there is a sense, first of all, that people are actually reaching a point for however long, where they're actually going to be looking at all their subscriptions and streaming and thinking, we need to have fewer of them because we're entering into a recession. And secondly, that, you know, there is now, again, it's a small snapshot, and it may not be really revealing of a general population feeling, but it probably is, you know, that sense that actually what most people feel at the moment about how they get their sport on TV is that they should be getting more for what they're paying.
Why is it that I'm paying all these subscriptions and can never see the match that I want?
Yeah, exactly. This season has been really pronounced because of the amount of games that have been on Sundays because of European competition on Thursday and stuff like that. But
I wish Owen was here to get into that Premier Sports fixture selection.
But that's where people are going in it. Why are we paying all the money we're paying for now? Not actually what I'd love to be. Maybe you'd say, right, I'll just pay if I'm just going to be paying Chelsea tenner a game or whatever. It's cheaper than paying Sky. Whatever. Maybe that's how it works out. So that could be. But it seems like it seems like the kind of forward projection that is very plausible.
Yeah. Sitting around a boardroom table.
Sitting around a boardroom table, and it could just work. But these guys will also come back looking for their money. So this is the thing that that he has to deal with. And I agree with Rory. Like, I think that the Liverpool numbers are kind of incredible. If they, I think if they can get 3 billion,
a Bowley size,
I suppose, like you'd be crazy. Look at Liverpool.
10 times they're investing 300 million. We've seen initially,
but there's
no question that like that is a figure that someone connected to FSG is putting out, because that's very much what FSG would like Liverpool. I saw a story over the weekend that like, oh, John Henry might be persuaded to accept a, you know, cut price bid of 2 billion. And you think, well, that's not a cut price bid. That's far closer to Liverpool's actual worth than the insane figures that FSG were putting out, because that's what they'd like to sell it for.
Like, there are so many variables in the Liverpool valuation. The key one being,
how much is someone prepared to pay for it?
But how sustainable is it when you look how the club was transformed by Klopp?
Yeah,
And he was such a key figure in the transformation. Liverpool hadn't been in the knockout stages of the Champions League
since 2009,
since for the entirety of FSG's ownership until Klopp came along, and then because there is a kind of curious thing that happens with Liverpool because of the history and their legacy.
You assume it's always been this.
Yeah,
right?
You assume this is another great night, European night at Anfield, and there's a golden thread from 1977 to 2022 or 2020, and that's not the case.
Yeah.
And when you look at what Newcastle went for, 300 million, if Liverpool didn't qualify for the Champions League, if Klopp left, there are a number of factors where you suddenly think, right, they're not going to go back down to 300 million. But it's suddenly a less attractive club, and there are so many variables there that I think clearly to do it now makes sense and get, you know, 2 billion. Rory's probably right; is probably a more realistic price for it.
Just to wrap up on this, Rory, you've been very good with your time. But what is your sense that this sale is actually going to be done sooner rather than later? And also, what's your sense of how John Henry feels about this? Do you think he's a little bit sore at the kind of pearls before swine aspect of his time leading the, you know, what more can I do for these? What more can I do for these ungrateful fans? You know, I've given them I've given them Klopp, I've given them a new, you know, 15,000 new seats, I've given them trophy after trophy. I mean, he didn't do that all personally, but you know, he kind of was in charge of the setup that made all these, a series of pretty good decisions, I would say.
To be fair, rich people didn't get to where they are today by not taking credit for the work of their underlings. Do you know what I mean? Like, John Henry will 100% take credit for Liverpool's trophies.
Look, you know, he incarnates their success and stuff. But lots of people are like, yeah, you know, go. We can't wait to see them back here, and just want to shake.
I saw someone describe it as one of the papers describe it as FSG's break-even policy holding Liverpool back, and I thought that sentence might sum up literally everything that's wrong with football. That some owners who think the club shouldn't be dicing perilously with massive debts are a problem. My genuine view, and I'm very much a pro FSG. I think FSG are good owners, and I think there is a possibility that they are as good an owner as you will get in reality. You can dream of kind of fan ownership or some uber wealthy kind of Scouse businessman from L4 who decides that, who's, you know, some billionaire that we've not heard of, who decides that he wants to plow all of their money into Liverpool. I think that's really unlikely. I think FSG is probably as good as it gets. And I suspect that whatever comes next will make them look a lot better. My instinct is that it probably won't happen that quickly. I don't have any information either way. I've seen
if they're thinking, well, look, you know, the next 5 years are looking, as Elon Musk said, dire. We're looking. Yeah. It's looking dire, and they're, you know, then, you know, what better time to get it done than while the World Cup?
I suspect that part of the reason that it's come out, and this isn't for a moment to kind of question David Ornstein's journalism, but is because FSG want it public so that they can see what's out there. This is, I think, inspired mainly by the amount of interest there was in Chelsea, that they've realised that the market is hot, and that now's the time to cash in. My instinct is, as far as I know, there's nothing on the table, which means you're probably looking at least 6 months before anything realistically can happen. The next year, 18 months maybe, is probably the most likely time frame, depending on what happens globally. Whether any of the names that we've seen mentioned, Steve Ballmer, Mukesh Ambani, you know, there's various things. I like the fact that someone linked them to Dubai International Capital the other day, a company that was dissolved 3 years ago. That seems like a great idea.
They're considering a $5 billion bid.
There's a lot of kind of smoke, not much fire, I think. Is Henry Saw, I suspect that if they get, you know, if they got 2 billion quid on a 300 million investment and then, maybe 100, 150 million more of their own money that they've put in, then I think they'd be, any soreness would probably be erased. I wouldn't be surprised. I think Henry's main takeaway from his involvement with football will be a degree of bafflement. I think he probably feels that you can do your best for a team and you can make decisions that to you in Boston, sort of sitting there cold and calculating in a sort of ambivalent rather than negative sense, and that you can see on paper are the best things to do for the club, things that make perfect sense on a business perspective. And then you get this furious backlash and this complete lack of gratitude. I think he probably will find that slightly confusing, but ultimately, you know, none of us should kind of mistake the motivations of any of these people. Not one owner of a major Premier League or European team is in it because they love football. There is no, you might be able to make the case of like Delia Smith wants to do it for Norwich, but the vast majority, you know, even Matthew Benham and Tony Bloom, they might support those clubs. But, you know, their motivations are at least partly proving themselves to be incredibly clever. They're not, there's very few like purely motivated owners in football. Henry was in it to make a profit, and Henry will make a profit if he sells it. So that is kind of, that's his metric by which his success will be gauged.
Mission accomplished. Rory Smith, Dion Fanning, thanks a million for talking to us about all that this morning.
Thanks, Ken.
Thanks for having me.
Yo, I'm getting ready to put y'all up on something, man. Yo. Put some respect on my name. I've won five World Cups.
It's personal between me and I'm going to do you some serious harm, you big stiff idiot.
Okay, all right.
Who are the people who are going to get together and go, ugh?
Like, you know what I mean? Like, yo.
Are Kante and Rudiger going to be like, ugh? As Filicueta and Jorginho, like, ugh. Little pack of alpha dogs, like, ugh. Is Mason Mount the senior man? Ugh.
Who's it? Who've we got here? You know, he thinks he's the dogs. He thinks he's all that.
We're live on Channel 5. All right, go on, one more. Also, they're gonna need 10 plumbers to do you when I've got to finish with you. Also, you are getting it.
Okay, one final word on Ronaldo, even though we've both expressed a desire to not talk about Ronaldo. But I think one thing we haven't really talked about is this kind of well-worn trope in modern-day football is that players are now ungovernable. You know, players of this stature are ungovernable. But Ten Hag has actually managed to sort this out. Now, obviously, not all top-level players are going to handle this as badly as Ronaldo has. But I don't know how successful Ten Hag is going to be as Manchester United manager. But this has been an unqualified success on his part. Yeah. Because it's the toughest part of the job in a lot of ways. Like, this idea of trying to manage top quality players it does often look like an impossible task, but he's done it almost perfectly, I would say.
Well, I think the main thing Ten Hag has done actually has nothing to do with Ronaldo, and simply it is that he's getting good performances out of players and the team is clearly playing better than it has been for some time. You know, look at, say, Rashford and how he's kind of resurgent. Bruno Fernandes is playing much better than he did last season. Eriksen has been added to the team, I think has been really good. Dalot has been like almost the he's one of the players with the most minutes in the entire team. He's
after kind of, Haaland, probably player of the year.
He's just kind of eased Maguire out, you know.
Again, another example, I suppose.
Just like, yeah, thanks, Harry, but you know, we're gonna go another direction. And obviously Antony has made a decent start as well. So you've got like a lot of things which are starting to go well for United in this, and a feeling that, oh, you know, and then of course wins against Liverpool, against Arsenal, Man City, maybe not the, you know, wasn't great, but there's been a lot for them to sort of feel good about. This has been after a couple of really bad years, really. I know it was the second place in the 2021, but like, you know, it wasn't really. That was a season which they still got smashed by Tottenham at the very big. You know, remember the six? I don't think anyone ever really felt, yeah, this is going well. And obviously it culminated in that awful Europa League final defeat. So for a long time, it's kind of felt like this. Now it sort of feels like, yeah, maybe we're getting somewhere. You know, maybe something is coming together.
Even watching Arteta at Arsenal is kind of, okay, so the guy in charge has an idea. Now, how good the idea is, we don't know. How good the manager actually is, we don't know.
But you couldn't feel that with either Solskjaer or Mourinho. But with Solskjaer, it was like, he doesn't really have an idea, does he? Like, it's kind
this
of...
This is just vibes.
And with Mourinho, it's just Jose doing his thing, and it's all kind of, it's all bullshit at the end of the day. So you're not building anything. Whereas with this, it's different. And then, you know, players like Garnacho coming in and suddenly showing that they can maybe... We have players we didn't even realize we had. You know, that kind of... That's what it's all about. Like, and then Ronaldo just whinging about everything is just... Well, sorry, but you haven't really... don't you understand? We're all pleased about how things are going. So he's just clashing horribly with the prevailing mood, and which is why I think no one's really... I mean, obviously, there are like millions of Ronaldo bots or whatever who are always going to be on... his side. I mean, that seems to be just a feature of the way things are now. They're just super celebrities who have, but like everyone who's remotely interested,
tuned into this,
or cares about how much United do, can see. Yeah, I mean, this is all history now. It's all over, and this is just kind of embarrassing for everybody. And actually, ultimately, it's embarrassing most of all for Ronaldo himself, because it's bad that like this is going to be the end of his. The end of how things are at Manchester United, because they love Ronaldo. They loved him. You know, they used to sing his name when he was playing for Real Madrid. Remember when he went back there, he went back there to knock them out with Real Madrid in Ferguson's last season, and they were singing his name. You know,
And so and like, you know, they'll be saying his name in 5 or 10 years' time as well.
They will, because everyone will forget
pointless,
this, like,
ridiculous coda to his career.
It is. Know? It's pretty sad.
So. That's pretty much it. World Cup build-up is going to be huge all week. There's also Ireland against a, unfortunately, Haalandless Norway on Thursday night. So if you're not...
Yeah, did you see that?
Unbelievable, isn't it?
Unbelievable.
Disrespect being shown.
He bottled it. Well, because what's it all about for these guys at the end of the day?
Well, he saw what Collins did to Jackie Grealish and just decided, oh, don't fancy that.
Collins got a real good look at the Premier League from a good vantage point down near the bottom there. He can see the whole field ahead of him.
He can.
Just like he could see the whole Ukraine team ahead of him that night in Woodge.
He made mincemeat of him.
He can plot a course through there. So, you know, it's all about goals per game, average for these guys. And Haaland just thought, you know what? I think I might sit that one out. You know,
I know when I could pad my numbers.
Ireland away on a Thursday. That doesn't look to me like I'm going to do Puskás numbers there. So maybe I'll just judiciously make myself available for the second of the two matches.
Wolves bottom at Christmas, but no need to panic just yet.
The only way is up.
Thank you very much, Ken.
Thank you very much, Kieran.
And of course, this is your regular reminder that Second Captains is part of the Acast Creator Network.
That's the second time it's gone off. They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine, it's not that at all. It's the opposite of that, it's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.